This is the University Spotlight on Beyond the Headlines. I'm KUNR General Manager David Stipik. We often bring you news about the university's cutting-edge research and the bright minds of the leaders who make it all possible, and today is no exception. University of Nevada, Reno Provost Kevin Carman has brought one such researcher to our studios today. Welcome, Kevin.
Thank you. Good to be here, David.
And we have a lot to talk about today, a lot of technology and science going on in this conversation. So as we get started, Kevin, why don't you please just jump right in and let's go ahead and introduce your guest today.
Yes, I'm going to start my introduction with a digression. If you'll indulge me, when I had the privilege of interviewing for the position that I now hold at the university over 3 years ago in the fall of 2012, I was taken on a tour of campus and was directed to a laboratory of a certain faculty member in geology, and it happened to be Scott Tyler, who is our guest today. And I learned about the program, the research program that he's leading, the incredibly diverse multidisciplinary program that we're going to hear about today. But Scott is a great example of one of our outstanding faculty on this campus. He's got that strawberry blonde Robert Redford thing going, just a super guy all around. And I think you're going to be very interested to hear about all the things he's doing.
Well, Dr. Scott Tyler, welcome to KUNR and the studios. And as Kevin has set you up already with his glowing introduction, let's start with a little bit more background about you. How long you've been on campus and what's your role here at the university?
Well, thank you. I've been here on campus about 25 years. I'm actually a graduate PhD, did my PhD here at the University of Nevada, Reno in hydrology. So I've been off and on campus and a little bit up at Desert Research Institute to begin with.
So hydrology is studying all things water for the most part.
All things water, whether it's liquid, gas, or frozen.
There's a lot of things that you've done in the past or been part of, some research going on around the globe. There's active projects right now. What is the top of your mind that our listeners might be most interested in finding out about current research?
Well, that's a good question. Right now, we've got a couple of projects that we've been doing overseas in the Antarctic, looking at ice shelf melting and changes in sea level. So we actually drilled down through almost 700 feet of ice and dropped a fiber optic cable down through a hole about an inch and a half in diameter and ran it down almost a kilometer into the ocean. And we've been measuring the ice temperature, the ice melting, and the ocean temperatures underneath the Ross ice shelf in Antarctica.
When you say fiber optic cable, give the non-science person in me a sense of what that is.
Okay, so we all use fiber optics in our daily lives, everything, our communication, our television, anything like that. And about 10 years ago, I was visiting a group in Switzerland, and I came upon a technique where we can actually shoot a little pulse of laser light down an optical fiber and watch the light that comes back from that and actually measure the temperature of the optical fiber or the fiber optic cable every 10 centimeters, so every few inches, every second, continuously, for as long as 20 or 30 miles on a cable.
Amazing.
An optical fiber is a human hair diameter, and then, of course, it's wrapped in all kinds of other things to protect it. And we took one of those, and we dropped it down through this a hole we drilled in the ice shelf, and it's been dangling down in the ocean since about 3 years ago now, and measuring the temperatures in the ocean and measuring the rate at which the ice is melting from below. And that's critical because the ice shelves down in the Antarctica actually control the big ice sheets, which are the glaciers that are behind them. And if these ice shelves are melting out, and they're melting out a bit faster, we think, these days, then the rest of the ice that's in Antarctica comes barreling down into the ocean and raises sea level a few feet at things like that. And that's incredibly fast, at incredibly fast rates, and that's a big deal for all of us here.
Now, you've taken this fiber optic mode of environmental sensing and really parlayed it into some really fascinating other applications on land and in lakes and in the air. Why don't you tell us about sort of the broader impact of this fiber optic sensing that you've developed?
Well, sure. Well, it actually started about 7 or 8 years ago when I came back from Switzerland. We were working on the Walker River Basin project, we said, look, this is a great technique for measuring irrigation efficiency and how water gets back into the river. And so that was the first opportunity. It was on that project. We actually purchased one of these instruments and built it up and laid it out there and was able to measure impacts of how much groundwater comes back into the river from irrigation. Since then, we said, well, this is pretty neat. Let's talk to the National Science Foundation and build ourselves an instrument center here on campus, which would specialize in this technique and actually get it out into the research community around the country and around the world. So about 6 years ago, we were funded by the NSF, the National Science Foundation, to be a community user facility for this instrument. And so we have about 6 or 8 of these fiber optic temperature sensing boxes in our lab, and we get researchers coming from around the world and around the country, and their students come here to UNR. We train them how to use it, and then we send them out in the field and doing things as diverse as measuring salmon habitat in California. We've got some projects looking at the Dead Sea in Israel and how it's changing as water gets diverted. Some projects looking at the effects of wind farms on atmospheric mixing up in Oregon. So we actually hang a fiber optic cable off of a drone or a balloon and measure the profile in the atmosphere. And we can then start looking at how those things are mixing, how the big wind farms mix the air. So it's all over the world.
You mentioned the word drone. Everybody in Nevada has heard of the drones, and we're a drone state now and we're a testing site. And we have the NASIC program that is promoting the use of drones in Nevada, and I know that you're part of that. So tell us about how drones play into your research.
About 3 years ago, after the National Science Foundation figured out that we were pretty effective at getting fiber optic temperature sensing boxes out to the community, my colleague at Oregon State and I, we sat down and said, well, what's next? What's the next amazing, game-changing tool that we have out there in environmental sensing that people want to use but is hard to use? And drones fell into that pretty quickly. This is an amazing technique where we can go out and measure temperature, topography, just aerial photography across the landscape at incredible resolution, much cheaper than we could do with aircraft or helicopters. And we said, well, let's make that our next mission here on campus is to have drones as part of our instrument center on campus. And at the same time, the NASIC Center, the Nevada Advanced Autonomous Systems Institute, was just getting off the ground, funded by the governor's office. We parlayed that with the National Science Foundation and said, look, we've already got university funding to start working in drones and autonomous systems. Let's try to do this. And the National Science Foundation said, okay, give it a try. So we've only been funded to do it for about a year. We were flying through the summer, and we're going to be flying quite a bit this summer.
And Kevin, this speaks to something you and I have spoken about on other interviews, the collaboration across campus. I know that Zeb Hogan has been part of the work that Scott, you've done, and other players on campus. How important is that collaborative aspect from the university perspective to you, Kevin?
I love it. Scott is really sort of a poster child for people who don't look at departmental or college boundaries. I mean, you look for the people that you need to collaborate with, and you work with them, whether they're at DRI, at other institutions, or in other departments and colleges here at the university. And something I really admire and we value and we want to see more of. And when I say poster child, I don't mean that in any negative way at all.
It means
he's just a great example of the type of environment that we're really trying to promote and the type of faculty that we have here at the university and want to see more of that sort of thing.
And Scott, you get a lot of value from the other experts and all the resources on campus as well.
It's a collaborative effort. And one of the exciting things that's happening here on campus, also in the last few years, we've really begun to hire a whole bunch of young faculty, new, really, really bright faculty who are really focused on research and bringing their research into the classroom. And that's been a game changer on the campus. The campus just feels really lively right now. And it's a hoot. It's just really fun.
You're listening to the University Spotlight on KUNR's Beyond the Headlines. I'm David Stipik with University Provost Kevin Kerman and his guest today, Scott Tyler, Foundation Professor of Geological Sciences and Engineering. We're discussing Dr. Tyler's work in temperature monitoring related to environment and some fascinating science and technology involved in the current work, as well as some things that have happened in the past. I've asked a little bit about your work with water. Lake Tahoe came into our conversation before we went on the air. You said there's not really a current project there, but talk about Lake Tahoe in the global perspective of all the work that you're doing.
Well, sure. We actually started working in Tahoe about 10 years ago with this fiber optic temperature sensing system, dropping a cable down into the lake and measuring lake mixing, which is important for water clarity up at the lake. And we've been doing that now expanded to a lot of different lakes. But Tahoe and others, there was just a paper that just came out a couple of weeks ago that looks at global temperatures in lakes, temperatures around the world, and what we're seeing, just as we're seeing in all the other climate records, is we're seeing warming in the lakes. And the Lake Tahoe is also warming in general, particularly in the upper parts of the water column. We also have a project right now. We're looking at Lake Shasta, which is the biggest reservoir in California, provides probably 30% of the electric power generation in California on the Shasta Dam, and also supports a really thriving, at various times, a thriving salmon population downstream in the Sacramento River. And with last year's drought, there's quite a balance going on between keeping the salmon alive, keeping cold water in the river, and also keeping water downstream for farmers and for other interests downstream. So the Bureau of Reclamation and NOAA, the National Oceanic Atmospheric Administration, asked us to do the same thing that we've done in Tahoe, which is lower an optical fiber down into Lake Shasta to measure in real time, continuously, every few inches in the water column, the water temperature. And for them, they're not particularly concerned about what the temperature profile looks like. They're really interested in how much cold water do they have, because they have to release cold water for the salmon at a particular time in the Sacramento River. And so this year, with the drought, the lake was down about 150 feet. And managing that resource, I think we helped them a little bit make sure they had enough cold water. It was pretty exciting dropping a cable down right in front of it's about a 700-foot-tall concrete dam that was active and water gushing into it. So it was kind of exciting.
This field of water study, hydrology, did you realize it was going to be such a big deal when you got into it?
No, of course. This is the way many of us are. Life's a bit of a pinball machine. And I happened to be lucky enough when I was doing my undergrad in engineering, I was going to design jet aircraft engines as an engineer. And got kind of interested in taking a geology class and sort of followed that to follow water. And ever since then, it's just been a heck of a ride. So I just want to encourage young students out there is don't necessarily get channeled into what you think you're going to do. Just keep your eyes open. And if somebody offers you an opportunity to work in a lab or go do something different, or some professor just gets you a bit excited, go for it. Just follow your dreams.
That may be a good opportunity to segue. I think we hopefully have convinced our listeners that you're into research at a very high level with funding from the most prestigious organizations in the United States. You are also somebody who's been recognized in Nevada. You're a foundation professor, one of our top professors in the state of Nevada, and you were recently recognized as a fellow of the American Geophysical Union. And I'm going to stop bragging on you here. But you're also a great teacher. And you talked about students getting into the classroom, getting involved in research, and I think that that's something I really want our readers to understand, that outstanding faculty like you aren't just off in Antarctica or in Lake Shasta doing great things. You're also involved in the classroom and in the laboratory, engaged with students. And would you tell us a little bit about what do you teach and how do you interact with students?
Okay, sure. Well, I mean, I think it is really important to have an active research program, because then you can bring that back to the students and you can excite the students with cutting edge things that are going on today. So I teach sort of all across the spectrum. I've taught Geology 100, or sometimes called Rocks for Jocks. And in fact, just ran into one of my old students just the other day, and I was surprised that she said she actually enjoyed the class. So, Then I teach a lot of hydrology classes, so water resources and contaminant transport, things like nuclear waste. That's always a big issue here in Nevada, so we teach a fair amount of that. And then even things like atmospheric sciences. How does the water go from the land surface through the plants and up into the atmosphere? That's where most of our water goes back up. That's where most of it's used. So I try to teach across the spectrum, from 100 level classes, intro classes, up to graduate level classes, and try to get the grad students involved with undergrads where they can. So
do you have students that are engaged with the research projects we've talked about?
Yeah, I've got about right now I've only got about 4 or 5 students and a few postdocs, grad students, working with me right now, but we've had as many as 10 or 12 grad students in the team. And then we always have a few undergrads that we rope in to help out, do special projects. And so it's a pretty vibrant place. My lab manager tells me that things are always in chaos mode, but we do have a lot of fun. And I think the students do too.
It's great.
I have a question for you about your students. What in this generation of students that you're now seeing, what are you learning from them? And is that different from past groups you've seen? Or this more technologically savvy digital world of students coming through?
Actually, in a really interesting way. So when I was in graduate school and undergrad, and that's back in the Pleistocene times, back in the 70s, you know, I did all my computer programming and I carried around a set of cards, punch cards. Now, nobody knows what those are anymore. So we wrote our own programs and did our own computing. And then for a long time in the 80s and 90s, students just took whatever Bill Gates or anybody else gave them as a program and they just ran with it. And what I see now is the students are going back and learning programming languages and really excited about actually writing their own codes and understanding what numerical models and what computer programs actually do.
And they're making changes and adaptations and building their own programs.
Oh, completely. I mean, most of the time I have no idea what they're doing down in my lab.
Well, while we're doing this interview, do you want to call over there real quick and check, make sure nothing's on fire or whatever? back to you, Kevin, for a moment. How does Dr. Tyler's work really open the doors for his colleagues, future colleagues? What does that do for the university?
Well, we are, as a university, focusing on areas that are critical to our future, and we can't be all things to all people, but there are certain areas where we really have an obligation to be among the world leaders, and hydrologic sciences is certainly one of those areas. We live in an area that is dry, will always be dry, at least within the next few hundred years in the area that we live. The climate is changing. We can be really a laboratory for the world in terms of how to deal with changing climate and arid conditions. And the work that Scott is doing in bringing in colleagues from different disciplines and having a global perspective that is relevant to local issues, that's exactly the sort of thing that we are promoting and need to do here at Nevada. So again, it just fits beautifully into our future as a university.
And as we kind of wrap up here, I had one other project I want to ask you about, some work in Arizona. What's the application there?
Well, that was an interesting project. Colleagues from Arizona and New Mexico came along and said, well, we want to do a prescribed burn when we want to know what the soil temperatures are. And the best they could do is put a few thermometers out that most of them melted when they finished their experiment.
It's hot.
It was hot or hotter. And so we said, well, let's lay out this optical fiber that we had, and we had a fairly special one that we worked with one of the cable manufacturers to build. And we laid this thing out and across the landscape and burned it. And it didn't break, and it didn't burn up, and we could see the fire progression right across this cable. And again, the cable works by shooting a little bit of laser light down and looking at what comes back, kind of like a flashlight in a dusty room, and that tells us the temperature. And so it worked beautifully. In fact, we're shipping the cable off next week to a group in Western Australia who are going to do the same thing with eucalyptus fires over there. So yeah, it's you can do anything with this stuff. The sky's the limit.
As I wrap up, any other things we didn't cover, Scott or Kevin, that you want to make sure we mention about your work or the work here at the university?
I just encourage people in the community to contact us if they want to see some of this technology. We're always happy to have people come through the lab and visit, and we can explain this because it's not rocket science. Just sounds like it is.
It's fiber optic science, but I do recommend it. It's a vibrant laboratory. It's a fascinating place to visit and to learn more about what they do.
And you can find out more at our website, KUNR.org, when we post this interview after the show. That wraps up today's University Spotlight on Beyond the Headlines. I'm KUNR General Manager David Stipik. Thanks to my guest today, University of Nevada, Reno Provost Kevin Carman. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, David. And to everybody, welcome to another wonderful semester at the University of Nevada, Reno.
Yeah, absolutely. And Dr. Scott Tyler, Foundation Professor of Geological Sciences and Engineering, thank you for sharing all this very fascinating stuff, and keep up the great work.
Well, thank you, and thanks for the opportunity.
Good to have you here. And you're listening to KUNR.